With our annual service auction, as you've already heard, slightly less than 2 weeks away, I figure it's high time I deliver on the sermon topic I offered for a bid last year before this year's auction rolls around. And I will take heed to what we heard earlier and submit my bid, submit my item for this year during coffee hour. I'm one of the delinquent ones who hasn't done that yet, so I hope that the rest of you will follow suit and do the same. I've also noticed that this sermon of your choice item that I get offered is not usually put up until pretty well into the evening. I don't know if that's because some of the wine's been pretty well consumed by then, but it never ceases to amaze me how the bidding on this thing gets going. I sit there listening to it thinking, my gosh, would I pay myself that kind of money to hear myself? But I appreciate it. And I'm pleased to do this. And I was especially grateful this year when Harry Perkheiser, who was the winning bidder for 2006. Harry, did you and Jim split this one?
Yes.
All right, and you also did the bid on the choir numbers as well. All right, very good, very good. I was introduced then to a writer whose work I had not previously known. Harry handed me a couple of books, I believe it was clear back in the fall, and asked if I would work up a sermon on the author's life and work. The man is Scott Russell Sanders. I just read a selection of one of his books a few moments ago. He is a professor of English, distinguished professor of English at Harry's alma mater at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's also a very ardent environmentalist. Five of his 19 books have been published by our UUA Beacon Press, and the religious and spiritual content of his writings on nature and earth and the environment have a very pronounced Unitarian Universalist kind of a flavor to them. I know there's a very strong and vibrant UU congregation in Bloomington. I don't know if Dr. Sanders is a member there or not, but judging from what I've read of his work, he would certainly fit right in. And I was also struck as I read it how much of what he has to say kind of tags on or with what I've been talking about up here for the past couple of weeks. A lot of his work is about the necessity of human beings developing a true relationship of mind and spirit to the natural world. And while Sanders' writing is in nonfiction prose, it has much of the same flavor and tone and quality to it as does the poetry of Gary Snyder, whose life and work I touched on last Sunday. And his views on what he calls the spirit, with a capital S, strongly echo some of what I was saying 2 weeks ago about naturalistic theology when I was critiquing Dr. Richard Dawkins' book, God Delusion. In that sermon, I spoke, while acknowledging that I agreed with pretty much most of what Dawkins had to say, I also spoke of my desire to get past this debate on the existence or the non-existence of a supernatural supreme being. And much of Sanders' writings about what he calls spirit point to or aim at that kind of get past it region that I'm reaching for. So this gives me an opportunity to tie in some of Sanders' work with some of the things I've been talking about over the past couple of Sundays. And as I learned a little bit about this gentleman's life, I was really struck by how similar our paths, his and mine, have been. Excuse me. Beginning with the fact that we were both born in the year of 1945. He was raised in a rural area of Ohio. That sounds very much like the rural area of Ohio where I spent my summers with my grandfather as I was growing up in southern West Virginia. We were both raised in decidedly conservative Christian settings, Protestant Christian settings, where we were deeply inculcated with the Bible, its stories and its teachings, and we have retained our familiarity with many of those stories as well as our appreciation for some of them. Each of our fathers, his and mine, whose respective legacies the both of us apparently still struggle to come to terms with, had family ties that reached into the rural South of the early 1900s. A major difference in our upbringing in this area, however, is that my father was an absolute teetotaler, while Mr. Sanders' father had a lifelong struggle with alcohol, which he largely managed to keep hidden. And Mr. Sanders and I left our respective places of origin out there in the middle of the country, came east for parts of our higher education, and we both began our careers in the fall of 1971 after our respective periods of graduate study on a university campus in southern Indiana. For me, it was a small Methodist school called DePaul University, where I was the campus minister. For Dr. Sanders, it was, as already noted, professor of English at IU Bloomington, which is about 40 miles south of the little town of Greencastle, which is where I first landed. But here's where our paths part. I only lasted 3 years in Indiana. Mr. Sanders is still there. And I do mean there. If his writings are any indication, he is about as rooted in southern Indiana as anyone could be anywhere, while still having a rather cosmopolitan view of the world. He did his undergraduate work down here in Rhode Island at Brown University, and then got a doctorate in Cambridge. And that's Cambridge, England, by the way, Oxford University, not the Cambridge that's outside of Boston down here. And I appreciate, I got a kick out of reading a lot of his stuff. He has this very strong Midwestern identity, which you've probably already caught. And he wears that as a badge of honor. And he has some fun with it by pointing to the ways in which he was stereotyped by some of the supposedly more sophisticated types he met when he first encountered Ivy League culture at Brown University. You read a little bit. I never thought of myself as a Midwesterner until I left Ohio for college in Rhode Island. The people I met there, who came mostly from cities bordering the Atlantic or Pacific, claimed they could hear the rustle of cornstalks in my voice, could see the roll of glacial plains in my work, could detect in my manners and politics the domes of county courthouses. I doubt that my origin showed quite so plainly, but my fellow students, on hearing where I was from, saw what they expected to see. Who else but a Midwesterner, they asked me, would refuse to drink alcohol, smoke dope, or sleep with a willing girl, refuse even to swear? I was considered a bit odd back home as well, I answered. But they were not listening. Where else but in the Midwest, they wanted to know, could one find the garish, baggy shirts I wore? My mother had sewn those shirts, I answered. There, you see, who else but a Midwesterner would wear shirts his mother made? I was square, my new friends assured me, as the wheat fields they spied from airplanes while zooming over the vast, vague, lonesome land that separates the Allegheny Mountains from the Rockies. During my brief Indiana days, I had a close friend, he remains a close friend, and a seminary classmate who lived and worked in Bloomington after choosing a career other than the ministry, returned to his home there to become a therapist. We spent a lot of time together, he and I did, in the early 70s, and I got a good feel for the southern Indiana terrain, about which Sanders writes so devotedly, even though, as I say, I spent a rather short period of time there. The book from which I read that passage earlier, before the choir sang a very wonderful song this morning, it's called Writing from the Center. And Sanders means that in two ways, both figurative and literal. He means writing from the center of your being, from wherever your personal centered focus happens to be. And he means it in a geographically literal sense as well, writing from the center of America. And if I were to try to boil down the message of this book, as well as most of his writing, what I've been able to read, I would have to say it would be his admonition to his readers to know two rather simple things: where you're from and where you are. Simple things in a way, but with a lot of not so simple dealings behind them when you really go to start investigating that. Where you're from, where you are. About knowing where you've come from. As I read some of Sanders' accounts about his early years in rural Ohio and their lasting impact upon him, I recalled some words by a Universalist minister and educator, one time dean at St. Lawrence University, the late Reverend Angus McLean. Dr. McLean held that in order to be at peace with your past, you need to go through a process of what McLean called, some appreciation, some understanding, and some forgiveness. You may not, you may very well not be able to do all three of those things, but the path that McLean sets out with that is a very good one. And it's one, whether we ever heard of Dr. McLean or not, it's one that Sanders is clearly walking in much of his writings. His connection, his spiritual ties to the land upon which he was raised is clearly appreciated and loved as he experienced the growth of both the crops and wild foliage it brought forth, the animals who were fed by those crops and who in turn provided food for human beings. He has a deep love for his family of origin, and that love carries through a generation later in the letters he writes to his son and the son and the daughter that he and his wife Ruth raised upon their marriages. He appreciates the faith in which he was raised, even as his religious and spiritual journey took him in a different direction and to a different place. And he understands the positive impact the religion of his youth had on those who embraced it, even though he could no longer do so himself. He has a deep love for all his father taught him about how to truly see and relate to the world of nature, as well as for all he learned about self-sufficiency at the hands of his handyman father. Sanders' father, he does a lot of father stuff in this work. His father was raised in rural Mississippi in the early decades of the 20th century. And in writing of his early family visits back to that area, Sanders comes to understand how many of his father's views were shaped by that upbringing, even if he could not embrace them and even find himself put off by them. He's not an apologist for some of his father's perspectives and views on life, but he does gain a measure of peace with his own past by an understanding of how his father came to see the world, his world, his father's world, in the ways that he did. And I have to say, as I read that, I realized this is a process I've had to work through myself, even though my father has been gone for nearly 30 years. I felt very close to this man whom I've never met when he wrote the struggle it created with his deeply patriotic father when he, Scott, declared his opposition to the Vietnam War and embraced pacifism. While I've not embraced pacifism at the level that Sanders does, I recall going to very similar rounds with my father probably about the same time that he and his father were having it out. It is in dealing with his father's legacy as well that Sanders also reaches for forgiveness. He obviously cannot appreciate, and it's a struggle for him to understand, his father's alcoholism, but he is able to forgive him for the impact that his father's struggle had upon his own life. So that was the first thing I was kind of struck by: appreciation, understanding, and forgiveness. But these are the themes that come into play as Sanders writes about knowing, really knowing where you've come from and what it means to own your past. And yet, for all of his positive writings about having a sense of place and embracing the places of one's past, Sanders is hardly one to romanticize regionalism. He can administer a bite when it's called for, as these words demonstrate. Clearly, we are rid of some old regional markers, such as those colored and white signs over toilets, as I saw in my youth in Mississippi, or black jockeys faithfully holding lanterns beside front doors, or cigar store Indians, and we are well rid of the accompanying bigotry, boosterism, and smarm. We could get along fine without the phony regionalism symbolized by Confederate flags, by squinty-eyed cowboys peddling cigarettes from billboards, and by souvenir shops with genuine trinkets that have been mass-produced in third world sweatshops. Better to leave the map of our country blank than to smear it with lies. But it is this very same blank map that concerns Sanders the most. At one point, he makes the rueful observation that a person could get in a car at one end of the country, roll up the windows, set the climate control, put a stack of CDs, load in a stack of CDs, take off driving, stay only, eat only at chain restaurants, stay only at chain motels, and get to the other side of the country without having any idea as to where you've been or what you've seen. Now, he admits he's exaggerating in making such a charge, but he also goes on to say it's exaggeration for the sake of an honest point. And the point being that it's becoming increasingly difficult and challenging to know where it is that we truly live. Where we live, that is to say, when it comes to our particular spot on this earth, and when it comes to knowing the earth itself as our home. Hear his words again. If we are to live responsibly on earth, we will have to recognize that our true address is not the one listed in the phone book, but the one defined by the movement of water, the lay of the land, the dirt in the air, the animals and the plants, as well as by the patterns of human occupation, the buildings and crops, the language and the lore. To discover our true address, we will have to stay off the interstates, avoid the friendly franchises, climb out of our cars, hunt up guides who live heedfully in the place, and we will have to walk around with our eyes and ears open to the neighborhoods. Well, that last line, walk around with our eyes and ears open to the neighborhoods, is a pretty apt description of how Sanders has lived his life in and around Bloomington and southern Indiana the last 35 years. For much of his writing is about what his open eyes and his open ears have revealed to him as he explores the neighborhood, so to speak, that makes up the part of the world that he inhabits. And in seeing this particular neighborhood, he also senses the greater neighborhood in which he lives as well. The limestone beneath the foundations of my house here in Indiana were formed by a great inland sea that stretched from what is now Pennsylvania across the Great Plains. The honeysuckle that blooms in my backyard is a wild offspring of plants brought to this country by Asia. The swifts that nest in my chimney spent their winters in the Amazon basin. And the mulberry, one of our neighborhood trees, flourishes in Massachusetts and Florida, from Minnesota to Oklahoma. So the challenge that Dr. Sanders is presenting to his readers without having to expressly say it is to know what your address really is and how that address connects you to the greater neighborhood in which we all live. But in addition to knowing where you've come from, knowing where you are, and what your actual address is, still another and possibly most powerful aspect of Sanders' work is about knowing and sensing how you are related, in the deepest and most far-reaching sense of the word, to where you are. And I thought about that, and I realized that for me to even just think about, I guess what you'd call my superficial address, the number that's on the house, on the street, where I live, even that really bespeaks a relationship. It probably does with any of you who've lived in the same home for some time. Even that bespeaks a relationship about how I live there with my family, with the things that I and we have done, with all the pieces of my life that are invested in that house where I've lived for nearly 18 years. Even a street address denotes a relationship. So what kind of relationship, then, does our earth-based address call us into? This is a theme of another of Sanders' book called The Force of Spirit, which I did read, and of his most recent work that I've not read called A Private History of All, A-W-E, Private History of All. And what Sanders is pursuing in both of these books is one of my ongoing pursuits as well. This is one I spoke to some last week, which is how do we create a language of reverence and awe and wonder that will allow us to speak to and better understand and grasp our relationship to our planetary address. And in an interview following the publication of A Private History of All, Sanders states, I want to help recover the original meaning of the word, awe. which signifies a twofold response to the world. On one side are wonder and emotion, and on the other are terror and dread. The wonder and emotion are evoked by the great size, age, complexity, elegance, and mystery of the universe. The terror and dread arise from our awareness of being tiny, fleeting creatures in this vast and unfathomable cosmos. To feel awe, one has to look beyond the minuscule realm where human beings can pretend to control things, pretending that the Earth is a spaceship and that we are the captains. And Sanders is aware that he's reaching for religious language, even as he's very wary of it. Again, him. Most of the religious language we hear nowadays from televangelists, politicians, and other pundits is lacking in reverence. When someone claims to know what God wants or whom God hates, as many public figures do these days, seems to me the height of arrogance. No human being can speak on behalf of the power that created and sustains the universe. And yet, paradoxically, that's just what Sanders is attempting to do in his book, The Force of Spirit. Or to be fair with him, he's trying to deal with the paradox that while no human being can speak on behalf of the power that creates and sustains the universe, we still have to search for ways of speaking about such a power if we're going to understand it, appreciate it, and live in harmony with it rather than work against it. And the power of which he speaks is something present in the natural world, and not some being or entity apart from it. And the term for such a power that he finally comes up with is simply spirit, which he also calls the fire of the heart of matter. If I can go one more round with his words, this is from his introduction to The Force of Spirit. In trying to show what binds together the seeming scatter of things, I find myself pointing to an elusive energy. When I glimpse it, I can do little more than cry, there it is. All the names we use for the fire at the heart of matter are risky. God, Yahweh, Allah, Manitou. For each comes freighted with a long and compromising history. For all the possible names, I favor spirit, because the word seems to catch the lightness, radiance, and wind-like subtlety of the power I seek. And then he closes on this note. I cannot predict when this force will visit me, any more than I can predict when the red-tailed hawk that hunts from the ridge behind our cabin will kite across the sky. I can only wait and watch. And I have to say, it is this kind of religious writing, thinking, and life stance that I'm finding myself most drawn to these days. And this was the point I attempted to make in discussing Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, in which he devotes 400 pages to debunking belief in a supernatural supreme being. You recall, those of you who were here, that I said I was in basic agreement with most, if not all, of Dawkins' arguments, and I see value in the kind of debunking that he does. But this kind of debate is simply not the conversation, or not the main conversation, that I find myself primarily interested in at this point in my life. And I thought about that a little bit. I thought, you know, I'd really like to meet Richard Dawkins, spend some time with him. I'd like to meet Scott Sanders and spend some time with him. But then I thought, you know, the proverbial gun to my head, you've got a choice. You can spend one evening with either one or the other of these guys, with Dawkins, listen to him hold forth for the non-existence of a supreme being, or with Sanders exploring how we as human beings can better cultivate a sense of awe and mystery and wonder and reverence for our world and universe, and how we find some way to speak to that sense. Forced to make the choice, I would really have to go with the guy from Indiana. And the guy from Indiana, by the way, is as science friendly as Dawkins, since he initially trained to be a physicist before switching to literature and writing. So I'm going to end on this. First, by thanking Gary for introducing me to someone that I feel a personal connection with his writings. Sanders can put himself into his work in some very moving kinds of ways. And I can see how people who would read his work might want to travel to southern Indiana to see the land that Sanders feels such a connection to see all that he sees in it. And I can say from personal experience, southern Indiana is a beautiful country. It's not this overwhelming, knock-you-down kind of beauty that you find, say, in California's Big Sur area, but it's a more subtle kind of beauty that does reveal itself. If you look closely enough and longly enough, you check with Harry Green Coffee, he'd probably tell you the same thing. What's the name of the town you're from? Like
Salem.
Salem, Indiana. Yeah, I think I know where that is, too. All right. And for those who might wish to go to the environs of Bloomington to see this land that Sanders portrays so well with his wonderful gift of language, I don't believe he'd tell you not to come, because he's too, you know, decent and polite and homey kind of a Midwest guy to do that. But he would probably say, if you're coming here to see what I describe, then you're not quite getting it in terms of what I'm trying to write about. I am looking, I think he would say, as closely and deeply as I can at the world that surrounds me, in the hope that you will do the same, wherever you happen to be, whatever your address is. For it is when we learn to look and touch and sense and feel the land around us in the way that this Indiana guy does, and that so many others are now learning to do, we might just save this land and this earth for ourselves, for all the life that lives in it and on it, on into the future. Let's sing together, number 77.